Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt podcast, bringing to you the best voices on the stories and issues that matter. Here's another piece I'll trust you enjoy.
We're going to take a deep dive into a single topic that many American media want to gloss over. They don't want to cover it. And that is, what did we get wrong during the COVID pandemic? What still needs to be fixed? And how do we restore trust in our public health system while modernizing it with innovations like the telehealth industry? Virtual medicine care isn't just a convenience. It's becoming a necessity in the 21st century in order to help make things easier, not just on patients, but on traditional healthcare providers as well. In a world where time is precious and access to medical care is often challenging, telehealth has become an absolute game changer. I use it all the time now. And 4 or 5 years ago, it wasn't even on my radar. This is especially true in rural America and in low-income communities, too. Imagine consulting with your doctor from the comfort of your home or simply having the ability to order an emergency first aid kit, your much-needed prescriptions, or your favorite vitamins and supplements from the convenience of your smartphone. That's actually what's happening today. The advancements in telehealth technology have made it possible to monitor vital signs, conduct virtual examinations, and even to secure medicines and prescriptions seamlessly. But it's not just all about technology and getting seen. During a time of need, rather, doctors like Peter McCullough and companies like his, the wellness company, have embraced the shift wholeheartedly and driven remarkable innovation in a very short period of time. They've not only provided accessible consultations and medical goods that can be delivered right to your doorstep, they've also integrated wellness programs that promote preventative care, that keep us healthy so we don't get sick. The wellness company's success story has not been just about profits. Rather, it's been driven in large part by empowering people to take greater charge of their health care proactively. Tonight, our one and only guest for this special hour is on the front lines of this incredible transition. He's helping build a parallel economy within the healthcare system, and he has been super successful over the years. Dr. Peter McCullough is an internist and a cardiologist in practice and also serves as the chief scientific officer of the wellness company, our proud sponsor for tonight's show. And as you know, Dr. McCullough was one of the leading voices about what we got wrong in the COVID pandemic. He was right about so much when our public health officials were often wrong and misleading us. We're so honored to have him on today. Dr. McCullough, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
It's a great honor. And I want to start today because I think we're in the midst of one of the greatest transformations in our healthcare system in maybe a century. But all of us are seeing things that we never saw before. I was sick a few months ago, just a sinus infection. I called my doctor on a Tuesday afternoon. The first appointment available was next Monday. I was like, I'm not going 6 days with this. I go to the pharmacy. There are go pick up a prescription I've had for 20 years. And like, oh, we're out of it. Going to be 4 or 5 days before we can get it to you. There are macro changes in the industry. I want to start with the consolidation of doctors. It seems like the rise of these mega doctor practices, the end of the local private practice, has really transformed the industry. Is that true?
It is. It's so true. You know, over the last several decades and accelerated over the period of time of Obamacare being kicked off in the United States, where doctors went from independent practices, like, you know, most lawyers are an independent practice. Doctors were the same. They basically were forced through electronic medical record requirements, bureaucratic reporting, insurance companies, so many reasons. They were essentially forced into employment. And that's either employment in large groups that still can be independent, but more commonly, large groups under a parent operating group of a health system. So even though the doctors may not be directly employed by the hospital, essentially they're controlled by the hospital and the health system. That means no more independent types of protocols, innovation. And we found out when the pandemic hit, suddenly, doctors didn't have that kind of bold independence to be able to respond quickly and adapt quickly to what was happening.
It's just extraordinary. And there's, I think, a second dynamic. It became painfully aware for all of us. We all became painfully aware of it during the pandemic. We went to get medical supplies and like, we don't have them. You can't get a mask. I remember someone had a stomach flu, sent me out to go get a famous medicine you take when you're feeling queasy. And there was a one bottle limit. It seems like the supply chain was changing as well. I saw a story in the New York Times recently, 30% increase in drug shortages just last year in America. How did our supply chain get disrupted so much?
I had a chance to spend time with Rosemary Gibson, who's a clinical scholar, and she's author of China Rx. And what she told me, it was astounding. that essentially our supply of drugs has been outsourced, especially the root source of the drugs, almost exclusively to China. And the Chinese government severely undercut pricing in order for the purchasers, which are not Americans or even the pharmacies, they're actually group purchasing organizations, to then essentially contract with the Chinese. And the Chinese solidified their stranglehold over the supply chain. Now, the GPO doesn't matter if there's a shortage, because to them, they'll have a more expensive product to make a greater percentage on their on their bill of procuring that pharmaceutical. So drug shortages are a product of essentially a oligopoly down to a monopoly on the drug sourcing, and the fact that the group purchasing organizations, they actually stand to benefit if they're offering more expensive products instead of less expensive. So you notice the drug shortages, Sean, are with the inexpensive generic drugs.
They are. Yeah, that's exactly it. I have my blood pressure pill generic and 5-day wait. I used to get it, same day, no problem. It's right. Remarkable. Why was China so interested in being at the center of this monopoly? Obviously, there's the middleman, but China's the one that now calls the shots on a lot of this supply chain. How did we let that happen, and what was China's interest long term?
Boy, it's happened with consumer electronics. It happened with plastics and so many other areas, but they saw this one as a critical part to their economy. A lot of the, the root sources of the medicines are found in China, but they're also found elsewhere. They, certainly can be manufactured in the United States. But the Chinese government essentially supported these companies to get the prices so low. It drove the U.S. companies, and we used to have companies in Puerto Rico and elsewhere, essentially drove them out of business. The only other country that, in a sense, competes with China is India. India provides some generic drugs, but even the generic manufacturers in India, there's a big one in Israel, Teva, they actually have their original sourcing through China. So now we're stuck, because if we ever really got into a tough situation with China, in a sense, they could put the squeeze and shut off our drug supply.
And that would put our nation's health at grave risk. There's a question that when I start to talk to people about this in the real world, and we start discussing it, how did we get to this point? What part of our public health establishment, our private health establishment, who wasn't sounding the alarm? Because we lulled into this and we woke up one day and like, oh my goodness, how did this happen? Where are the failure points in the public health system that we weren't monitoring and adjusting for these realities?
Our public health system never really anticipated that we would have a crisis. And our hospitals and medical groups never did as well. We're essentially in the business of chronic diseases and then acute episodic care, but not a nationwide or worldwide crisis. I was a professor of medicine, highly ranked in multiple health systems in the course of my career. We never had a tabletop exercise or a fire drill on what we would do if there was a pandemic.
Wow.
It's interesting. It never came up.
That's amazing.
Yet the U.S. military was practicing. We now realize that Anthony Fauci and the National Allergy Immunology Branch was practicing. The Johns Hopkins School of Public Health was practicing with the SPARS pandemic and then Event 201. None of those were messaged out to us. It's not like we got an email in 2019 and said, members of the U.S. government and the Chinese CDC just held a planning tabletop exercise called Event 201. Here's important points about a possible future pandemic. That email never happened. Mm. It never happened. We never had a conference call on this. And so the doctors who were employed and essentially controlled by health systems, we were in a reactive mode, not a proactive mode.
That's remarkable. And then we saw what happened when all that came together. Now, as a result of the pandemic, I think there is greater distrust among Americans and the medical system, whether it's the COVID-19 shots and the things we weren't told or we're just learning about now, or just the top-down idea that your doctor didn't have a say over what he or she knew about you. You had to follow a regimen. How destructive was that moment in history where so much of the power in the medical system was shifted away from the doctor and their patient to top-down instructions that sometimes were quite wrong?
The Doctor-patient relationship is considered a fiduciary relationship. That is, the doctor is supposed to act in beneficence. What's in the patient's best interest? And so for the first time, doctors were pitted against that standard operating principle and what the health system told them to do. So if a doctor wanted to treat a patient for COVID, but the health system said, no, don't do this, or specifically don't use the available drugs that look like they're working, then the doctor was incredibly conflicted. Now, this was all in the setting of clinics being shut down, lack of access. Even if a patient got the medicine, the pharmacy wouldn't fill it. And then patients started to go on the scramble. And I can tell you, so many patients with acute COVID, they didn't even bother with their doctors. They heard on the street that doctors and health systems, medical schools were not treating COVID patients. They were dying once they get in the hospital. So people sought all kinds of alternative pathways to get the drugs, essentially the multi-drug protocols that were working, McCullough Protocol, FLCC, and others. And this was worldwide, by the way. This happened in every country across the globe. People went on the scramble.
Yeah, it is remarkable. Our system of health has always relied on a very important principle of informed consent. But it seems like in the COVID-19 shot, we were forced to take consent and we didn't have all the information. How troubling is it that a lot of the data is still not in the VAERS database? And a lot of the statements that were made by our medical health professionals to cajole us or force us into taking the shot didn't include the information we need to make a full consensual decision.
Yeah, we learned through a manuscript by Mead and colleagues in the Springer Nature Journal, a curious journal of biomedical sciences, which hit record views. It was seen by over 330,000 scientists. Now the journals retracted it because of intense pressure, we believe, from big pharma. But the paper concluded that, you know, the patients were never fully informed, that Pfizer did not disclose all the deaths that happened with their vaccine, even at the FDA meeting December 10th, 2020. So when these rolled out, all we had was what Pfizer told us about in the first month of actually getting the primary series and 2 months of observation. So think about this, John. No one knew what was going to happen on month 4, 5, or 6. No one knew. It was impossible. There was not sufficient time and follow-up. So it was a wishful thought that the vaccines would work. It was, in a sense, presumed that they were safe and effective. And the consent form should have said, listen, nobody knows what's going to happen after 3 months. No one knows. No one could have known. The consent form should have been fair. And I can tell you, as side effects started to come out, our government should have been meeting once a month, telling people what side effects could occur, put it on the consent form. The vaccines never should have been mandated. And when we hit a threshold for excess death, it should have been pulled off the market. And by my estimation, that probably should have happened January of 2021. It should have been a very short run for these vaccines, like it would for any other safety problem. Instead, here we are, you know, over 3 years later.
And it's still being pushed on people, certainly over the age of 65. It's extraordinary. I want to get to I think the biggest learning lesson for me as a journalist, which is it appears our government, our public health establishment, put all of its eggs in one basket during the crisis to the detriment of other things that could have mitigated all of us who got sick or died during that time frame. How big a mistake was it? And have we learned anything from that?
It was a colossal mistake. I published an op-ed in The Hill in August of 2020. This is before the vaccines came out. And this was for the House, the Senate, and the White House. The title of the op-ed was The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccine Development Program. That meant that the White House Task Force, the NIH, the CDC, and the FDA, they were singularly focused on the vaccines. They never gave multi-drug treatment protocols even a second chance. There was an early two-drug protocol that was shut down after just a few days. They had fully funded this program. There were novel drugs from Japan and elsewhere that never saw the light of day. It looked like there were going to be vaccines, and specific vaccines, messenger RNA vaccines, were going to be the featured ones that the government had in mind from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
We're experiencing instability at every level. Our government lacks leadership, and Bidenomics has been a disaster. The economy is in a fragile state. Inflation has been a consistent issue. High interest rates have put significant pressure on the real estate market. There have been major bank failures, and many analysts say a stock market correction is likely overdue. We have global conflicts in Europe and the Middle East that have the potential to spread, but gold has soared to record highs even amidst the tensions. There are so many reasons that Americans should consider investments in gold and silver, and Legacy Precious Metals is the gold standard. I love Legacy Precious Metals because of their zero-hassle, education-first approach. They can help you roll your traditional IRA into a gold IRA or ship metals directly to your house. Go to legacypminvestments.com to download their free gold investing guide. I've read it, and there's so much valuable information there. Friends, now is not the time to roll the dice with your hard-earned money. Find out about the growth potential that gold offers you. Contact Legacy Precious Metals today and tell them I sent you.
And they just locked into one thing and blinders were on, and the consequences were so extraordinary. You have been a voice of reason. And even in the middle of crisis, the efforts to cancel you and silence you didn't succeed. You came up with, I think, one of the most important roadmaps for not only what we are going through with COVID, but for any future health crisis, the four pillars of a pandemic response. Can you walk us through those for a second?
I've had over 70 peer-reviewed publications on COVID-19, despite headwinds and bias by editors and publishers that really gravitated to this government narrative. But what I said, listen, is that with any infectious disease pandemic, there should be four pillars of pandemic response. This was initially presented in the U.S. Senate November 19th, 2020. It was actually the format of an entire Senate session on this in December of 2022. And the four pillars are, number one, reducing the spread, that is control of the contagion. Now, our government focused on things that didn't work, including masking, hand sanitizers, and lockdowns. It turns out one intervention did work, John, and that was use of viricidal nasal sprays and washes. This is very important. So certain nasal sprays really do reduce spread of the virus, povidone, iodine, xylitol, colloidal silver, gargles like Scopper Listerine can add a drop of iodine, work perfectly fine. But when someone got sick with COVID, everybody should have been using nasal sprays and gargles. There's now over 20 studies, massive reduction in spreading the virus when we do this. So, you know, I can tell you this was a great missed opportunity. It was so simple. It was so cheap. What we found out actually is that the Federal Trade Commission tied up every one of these companies, didn't allow them to make any claims. FDA didn't allow any research. And I put this in my book, Courage to Face COVID-19. Our government did not want Americans to know about nasal sprays and gargles.
Unbelievable. Why is that? What motive would they have? Because they're supposed to protect the people, and yet they were taking something very simple off the table that could have protected us.
You know, this would have been very simple. It would have liberated people. And, you know, Anthony Fauci has said in interviews, he said, you know, a great purpose of lockdowns was to force people to take vaccines. Now the second pillar is the pillar of early treatment. Now, it turns out multi-drug protocols did work early. Our government never tested them, never featured them. No single drug was perfect, but we used drugs in combination, you know, in addition to the nasal sprays and washes, oral drugs, over-the-counter drugs like aspirin, vitamin D, vitamin C, quercetin, over-the-counter famotidine. They all had positive data. Oral antivirals, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, later on Paxlovid and molnupiravir. Way too much focus on the oral antivirals from my perspective. Antibiotics like azithromycin, doxycycline, the use of inhaled steroids, budesonide, oral prednisone, and then the use of anticoagulants. All of this made a huge difference. If we put the protocol together and really started on day one, I personally treated now hundreds, if not thousands, of patients, treated patients well into their 90s with heart and lung disease. I didn't end up having patients in the hospital if we treated them early and avoided the progression of illness. Sadly, virtually everybody who died in the hospital. So that's the third pillar, is in-hospital care. We never saw in-hospital care advance. So, yeah. For instance, a great missed opportunity was using monoclonal antibodies. They should have used monoclonal antibodies in the ER, and right. Every person who came in. Instead, they were hard to get. They were restricted to outpatients. There was no reason to do that. The inpatient care never took remdesivir off the shelves, even after the WHO said, don't use it. It's not working. It can cause side effects. So in-hospital care, patients put on the ventilator unnecessarily. In-hospital care to this day is really a black eye on the hospitals. There's no hospital system that claims it's a center of excellence. There hasn't been a single meeting to
that is
to
amazing, go over isn't
best,
it?
Best practices, John. It's amazing. And now the fourth principle is vaccination. And I think vaccination, if we had a safe and effective vaccine, I was leading the development of one of the vaccine programs early on, the Imodulon vaccine that never was featured in the United States research. But there, I would estimate about 2.7 million would be eligible for a vaccine, nursing home patients, congregate living, those working with them. We never should have broadly used a vaccine across the general population. All that did was cause the virus to mutate and keep being able to work its way around the vaccine, and then new vaccines, and the virus keeps mutating. So the vaccination program failed, and in fact, it's prolonged the pandemic.
Unbelievable. The do no harm rule actually became do harm, and it is remarkable now. I think we're coming to grips with it, but we couldn't even say those things at the time. We couldn't challenge the ideas that were being put on the table because there was such a censorship machine. And yet science and medicine are always supposed to be about the debate, testing theories and hypotheses. How did we get so askew? How did we abandon a century of sound science during this period?
I think it was driven by fear. Remember, doctors are always dispassionate. Yeah. They're comfortable. They don't have the disease themselves, so they can make rational decisions. But once we got to the point where doctors and nurses and other people felt threatened, rational thinking went out the window. And we saw all kinds of defensive postures. Most of the hospital and health system meetings I was a part of, it wasn't focused on the patients. It was focused on the healthcare workers, personal protective equipment, masks. And most hospitals were the same way. They were actually playing defense, not going on offense and figuring out how to treat patients early to avoid hospitalization and death.
Wow. One of the things that was widely deployed early on were ventilators. There seems to be a lot of science in medicine now that said maybe the ventilator wasn't the right way to go for acute patients. What are we learning about the ventilator in COVID that not only the fact that maybe it didn't work, but how we should have detected it wasn't working earlier?
One of the triggers for the mechanical ventilator was called the pulse oximeter. They measured how much oxygen saturation. And three studies demonstrated, believe it or not, that if we used multi-drug programs at home featuring ivermectin, that we could actually treat patients with very low oxygen saturations into the 80s. Actually, I treated patients into the 70s in my practice
Wow.
with home oxygen. Now, I can tell you, everybody with an oxygen saturation of 70 or 80 would have been put on the ventilator in the hospital. Now, these patients survived. They never went to the hospital. They never needed the ventilator. So we learned, actually, that the ventilator was grossly overused. We should have practiced what's called permissive hypoxemia. We should have let the oxygen saturation go down as long as the work of breathing was okay, the ability to think was okay, and use drugs in combination. Instead, once patients were put on the ventilator, now, there were ventilator-associated pneumonias, and one study shows even at autopsy, a significant percentage had bacteria causing additional pneumonia and lung damage that were not covered by the antibiotics used. So right. The ventilator actually caused untreated pneumonias, and patients suffered.
There are a couple questions that I always get when I talk to people out in the real world, and they say, why did we go the mRNA route? Why, when we did do the vaccine, and we should have kept the therapeutics going, but why the mRNA vaccine when it hadn't been tested and tried in any other circumstance before?
DARPA, the research unit of the military, in 2012, launched a program called the ADEPT-P3 program. It's still on their website today. And it said, that the military would end pandemics with messenger RNA vaccines in 60 days. And this was in 2012.
Wow.
So it turns out the United States had made a massive investment in messenger RNA, and governments all over the world did. Biotech companies, a paper by Lalani and colleagues in British Medical Journal said tens of millions of dollars, billions of dollars poured into messenger RNA vaccines all over the world, because the idea is that we could use it as soon as the genetic code is known for the organism, a computer can quickly model the messenger RNA and it can be produced. So, you know, we didn't have to worry about growing things in culture. And so the speed and the adaptability was so seductive to scientists that messenger RNA became, in a sense, the platform the government was going to use. And plans were in place by Moderna years ahead of time that said, listen, when this happens, the government owned 50% of the patent for the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine, that Moderna was going to be the lead. In fact, within a few days of former President Trump announcing the pandemic, Moderna said, we've got a vaccine. Yeah. Within a few days. It's like, how did that happen? It's the speed of messenger RNA. Now, Moderna sued Pfizer and said that Pfizer copied their genetic code for the vaccine. So Moderna was first, Pfizer was second, and then the Janssen was third with the adenoviral vaccine, which is similar to AstraZeneca. They're both made at the same place, by the way. The AstraZeneca and Janssen, now off the market, were made by Emergent BioSolutions, a biodefense contractor outside of Baltimore. And then we ended up with killed vaccines out of China, another adenoviral vaccine, Sputnik from Russia, and then Novavax, which was the only antigen-based vaccine. But our government wanted high-tech vaccines, none of the old-style vaccines. This was going to be a showcase of American private public investment in biotech. And you could see that the enthusiasm was through the roof for these products. It's just a shame what happened next.
Yeah. And what happened next? This is a question that I ask. If you have to take 6 or 7 shots of a vaccine, it clearly is not a vaccine. It's not creating immunity. What was wrong with the mRNA approach that caused these to be so short-term, maybe for a few months useful, then really useless after that and actually counterproductive?
The messenger RNA has been modified by both Pfizer and Moderna in the same way. It's called pseudouridination. They replaced one of the base pairs all the way through to really reduce breakdown. The messenger RNA stays in the body far too long. Not just a few days, but at least a month or more, maybe a couple months. Wow. And it is the genetic code for the spike protein, which is the lethal part of the virus. And so when these were developed, the scientists had no way to stop it. Once it got put in the body, there was no stop button to stop producing the spike protein. So it made sense to me, and I tried to warn as many as possible. I said, how are we going to shut this off? Some people are going to produce too much spike protein. The spike protein we know is lethal. It damages the heart, the brain, causes blood clots, causes immune system. How would we possibly shut this off? No one had any answer. And to make matters worse, because the body keeps passing the messenger RNA from cell to cell, and the spike protein is made over and over again, the body becomes, in a sense, tired of seeing this antigen, and it switches its subclasses of antibodies to what's called IgG4 antibodies, which are present, but they don't stop the spike protein. So in a paper by Yonker and colleagues from Harvard, it was a very important study. It showed that young boys in the hospital with vaccine myocarditis, they had plenty of antibodies against the spike protein, but it wasn't binding the spike protein. And so the spike protein was causing damage, where the kids who are fine had antibodies, but they were appropriately binding the spike protein. So Harvard showed that the vaccine raises antibodies, and in some, it doesn't do anything to stop the virus.
Mm. Wow. Would we have been better to go to an inert virus and do the old-fashioned way, even though if it were longer?
The Chinese tried that. They tried to kill the virus, and that didn't work either. Those were poorly effective. I think a vaccine strategy, the most intelligent one to me, was a cellular-based vaccine. It's called the Modulon, which was similar to a BCG vaccine used for tuberculosis. That could have been modestly effective in nursing home patients. But I think, honestly, the focus should have always been on multi-drug treatment. Yep. We should have had protocol after protocol, large trial after large trial. All the nursing homes should have been stocked with drug treatment packs, with monoclonal antibodies, so should the ER. We could have saved probably 2/3 of the lives lost.
That is an amazing, it's actually jaw-dropping to hear that, but I've heard that from many medical professionals recently, and it is an extraordinary legacy to think about that we could have done that. There's a moment where it takes a lot of courage to say, you know what, I'm throwing out Fauci's advice. I'm developing my own protocol, the McCullough protocol. I know it came at a cost short term, but for your patients, it came with an extraordinary benefit. Tell us how you developed the McCullough protocol. What happened when you did for your patients and also in the public sector?
Well, I worked early. It started in March. I had an investigation and a drug application with the FDA. I was collaborating with the Italians. We had our protocol together, submitted it in July of 2020. It's fully published in August of 2020. Fauci and the NIH did not come out with the first NIH protocol until October of 2020. So we are ahead of them with the original McCullough early treatment protocol, which was the first method of how to treat acute COVID patients. And then we came up with what you're showing now, McCullough protocol base spike protein detoxification, is how to treat patients who've had long COVID or multiple episodes of the virus and or taken one of the vaccines.
Unbelievable. It's just extraordinary. Big tech, big pharma, big media, big government all came in and tried to silence people like you who actually were developing the right way. How damaging was that? And have we learned any lesson in those communities that maybe next time they should keep their thumb off the scale?
I never was in social media. I didn't even know what it was back in 2020. My daughter convinced me to make a YouTube video because I was in an FDA-approved drug protocol for treat COVID. I had acute COVID. But so I made it was in my lungs, but I made a video of how I was doing. And within a few days, YouTube struck it down. And I just couldn't believe it. I just it had no offensive content. There was no reason for it to be struck down. It was all true. And then we started to realize that, oh, my Lord, there is actually an active censorship program that was going to censor any information on early treatment, any hope for people. Mm. It was going to censor any information on side effects of the vaccines. And the censorship program only promoted vaccines as the only method of, you know, having people survive the pandemic.
It is stunning to go and relive those moments. But we are so grateful that someone like you had the courage to be a disruptor, to be an innovator, because we're a lot smarter today than we were a few years ago. Doctor, I want to turn back to now what the solutions are, because you aren't just a person who highlighted the problems. You jumped into the fray and you've created some really disruptive, innovative, successful technologies. You got a lot going on in your life. You treat patients. You write these academic papers. You're one of the most versant people in the medical profession. People turn for expertise. And yet somewhere you got the idea, I'm going to start my own company. I'm going to do this. Tell us what drove you to start the great innovation that is the wellness company.
You know, Americans saw me on national TV hundreds of times during the pandemic, usually providing a counter narrative to Anthony Fauci. That was my most common role. But I was a critic of the government pandemic response, but I also provided solutions, not only the McCullough protocol for early treatment and now for detoxification. But I was recruited and happy to join the wellness company as the chief scientific officer, led by Foster Colson, who is from British Columbia. He is an innovator, an entrepreneur, comes from a very prestigious family that founded an aviation company. Now he's formed multiple e-commerce companies. But the wellness company leverages what former President Trump enabled, which was widespread telemedicine, widely available. The wellness company controls its own drug supply, its own pharmaceuticals, and is very affordable. Membership allows lots of access. There is one wellness, which is basically unlimited healthcare. Once is in that space, this can be an add-on to health insurance. Some people without health insurance just get one wellness. Telemedicine visits are very affordable, around $60 or so. Right. The drugs, now that the wellness company ships them out the next day, is very affordable. And then what you're featuring here, the ability to use home kits and with the assistance of telemedicine, handle problems at home.
It's an extraordinary innovation. I've been using telemedicine now for 2 years, and it is so convenient. And I think a lot of people who maybe haven't tried it yet think, well, this is like a video game, and I'm not going to take my health to video game. But you're in touch with a real doctor. You're getting your medicines from a certified pharmacy. the same medical protocols that you get from your doctor occurring is just happening in a virtual space, right?
That's true. And the doctors at Wellens Company order diagnostics at, you know, our standard nationwide lab systems, imaging tests if needed. The drugs, by and large, are generic and affordable. The key is to start treatment early. You know, people with infectious diseases, we can't wait a week into this to get going. The same thing is true by telemedicine and recognizing something serious. Some people just want to know, do they have a condition serious enough to go to the ER? And with a quick call, one can figure that out. Because believe me, if you take your chances in the emergency room or even at urgent care center, we're talking a lot of time and a lot of dollars.
Yeah, that's a great point. And maybe a long wait, too. That's one of the things people have experienced. It is so disruptive. Now, you have an emergency kit. And I think that everybody knows if you live in a hurricane zone, you got to be ready for a hurricane. This is a brilliant idea for the hurricane of a medical episode. Tell us why you created this and how popular it is and what you get in it.
The original emergency medical kit, which was the Aqua Blue kit, that's a broad emergency medical kit that can handle anything from acute bronchitis to a urinary infection, a yeast infection, a skin infection, nausea, vomiting, headache, other problems. Now, the kit is one kit per adult. It comes with a telemedicine assistance and a guidebook, but does, in a sense, coach people. And we think people are at this stage of medical sophistication to do self-diagnosis. I think someone can self-diagnose a bladder infection or a yeast infection, cellulitis, for instance, and then start medications right away. So that was the broad emergency medical kit. And then it expanded the specific COVID pandemic kit, the black one. Has a budesonide nebulizer actionator, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, which are the most rapid acting drugs that we have. The red kit is the first aid kit. That's the one out in the wilderness with all kinds of antibiotics, antiseptics, ways to treat wounds, animal bites, insect bites, etc. And then finally, the green travel kit. That's the one to take when you're on a cruise traveling. And the big threat there is actually infectious enterocolitis, or GI problems.
We know something about those if you've ever been on a cruise, for sure. Doctor, you have expanded from the core kits now, and there are many other medicines and medical capabilities that the wellness company is developing. You're really creating a 360-degree opportunity for people to get care. Talk about some of the other places you're going and building out through a telehealth product that we can get almost all of our medicines and our needs taken care of.
We recognize that there's now a great distrust of big pharma, that we had to provide solutions with various forms of nutraceuticals and supplements. And you're showing some of them right now. Each one we went over very carefully in terms of its formulation. These are all U.S. sourced and, very, very high grade. That you're showing the detoxification protocol there, spike support, which is nattokinase with five minor ingredients. We add to that curcumin and bromelain, the heart support. I recommend that to my cardiovascular patients every day. Sure. Kids spike support, that's for kids who've had COVID and struggling to recover or have taken a vaccine. Acute products like Z-Stack is what we need to boost the immunity when acutely ill. And so the supplements then empower patients to give a try at managing themselves without getting, in a sense, committed to pharmaceuticals. And many times we use the two together. They're very complementary.
Yeah. People who have watched you on this network, on Just the News and the podcast, all the things we've done, they remark on something. I think it's very true. You brought a different mindset to medicine. What is that mindset change that maybe some people who are stuck in an old way need to adapt to? What is it?
I guess I've always been a maverick in terms of my thinking. And so it does take intellectual courage, in a sense, to think out of the box. COVID really pushed us to think outside the box. Doctors went into one of two camps. They either retracted and waited for the government to tell them what to do. That was a disaster. Or they stepped out of the box and they innovated. And I led that innovation in so many areas around the globe. But many others, great credit to others that have contributed. You've seen them testify in the U.S. Senate, the House, as well as European Parliament. So Wellness Company has brought so many under their tent to lead things forward.
We are a better country because you were a maverick. There's no doubt about it. Dr. McCullough, I want to bring you back in. I think history has shown you took the right approach to COVID. You're disrupting and innovating right now. If President Joe Biden came to you tomorrow, or if in the next administration, if it's Donald Trump or a future president, what's the advice you would give them to jumpstart the transformation that the state public health sector still needs to make? There's a big transformation not happening there yet. What advice do you have for them?
The public health sector needs to restore trust. The single greatest thing they could do is pull the COVID-19 vaccines off the market. That's the call of the U.S. FDA. FDA reports to HHS. And it just simply has to happen. The longer they stay on the market, the more the public continues to recoil. A recent Rasmussen survey, January of 2024, indicates that 53% of Americans believe the COVID vaccines are causing serious side effects, leading to large numbers of deaths. There's just no way these vaccines are going to be turned around. You can't spin it any other way outside of great public concern and continued harm. Now, fortunately, few people are taking the vaccines, but they need to pull the vaccines off the market, initiate a deep dive on what went wrong with the vaccine program. The Vaccine Injury Compensation Act of 1986 should be lifted. Yeah. And I think Pfizer, Moderna, Janssen, Novavax now should be fully responsible in terms of safety of their products. This liability shield has made Americans furious right now. And there needs to be a fair and equitable way for people who have been injured or disabled, or sadly, if people have lost their lives, to have things made right for them. Very similar to what we saw with the Great Tobacco Settlement. So those would be my recommendations. You know, these actions wouldn't cost the government a dollar. In fact, it would save the government a large number of dollars, because right now the vaccine purchases continue. There is continued spend on pushing the vaccines through marketing arrangements with Weber Shandwick and the CDC and the HHS. All that needs to be dropped. We need to go back to finish out the pandemic with treatment by doctors like myself.
And doubling down on failure and distrust, it doesn't make any sense. And yet that's what's been going on. It's pretty remarkable. Sir, there's a lot of questions people have about the future of medicine. One of them, and you've been very articulate on this, I love your take on this, the rise of AI, artificial intelligence, and how it may help or harm medicine. Can you give us some top line thoughts before we wrap up for the day?
I tested AI, actually. We tested it and asked a question, and I think about side effects of the vaccine. And AI basically just spit out a government advertisement for the vaccine saying they're safe and effective. So please don't use AI to try to find the truth here. Yeah. But artificial intelligence could help doctors in the office, honestly, if it had some retrieval mechanisms or always looking for lab reports, x-rays, having things better presented to us. You know, I'm a doctor. I have to move fast. Things have to be presented to me. I can't be fetching. If the AI could develop to that extent, that would be terrific. There may be ways of AI assisting patients in crafting their vignettes to have them be more cogent for healthcare. So I wouldn't throw AI out, but right now I just finished a day in the office. I can tell you I didn't have an ounce of help from artificial intelligence.
That's good. I don't think I trust a robot doctor. I'd much rather have you as my doctor. That's the way to go. Last parting thoughts for where a medicine's going to go. We're entering into a really exciting but scary time. What are the biggest innovations that we're going to see that will change our experience over the next 5 years?
Well, we're going to see the rise of independent healthcare through telemedicine, companies like the Wellness Company, doctors in independent practice. Patients will get used to this idea that a cash-based system for some of their medical expenses makes a lot of sense. You know, there's going to be a value on well-trained, well-educated, good communicating doctors, mid-level providers, and others who will give an honest and independent opinion and not just toe the party line in terms of a government narrative or health system narrative, and particularly on the COVID-19 vaccines, other vaccines coming along that are showing safety problems like the respiratory syncytial virus vaccine, and then the future messenger RNA vaccines. I think Americans will continue to recoil because our government's not showing concern over safety.
Yeah, that's really there. The Wellness Company, every time I go to site, there's something new. What's next for the Wellness Company? It is at the forefront of the frontier of the next generation of medicine.
People should take a careful look at One Wellness. One Wellness is like a all complete package, monthly fee to this that's under $200. Wow. Unlimited healthcare, unlimited supplements. This is less than what people typically spend on a, you know, a cable TV view bill. And you know what? They have a tremendous ability to then control their own healthcare. So for those who have no healthcare insurance, I saw a patient like that today. This is a wonderful, wonderful option. Those with diabetes, high blood pressure, frequent checks, you know, additional healthcare needs. One Wellness is the way to go. You're going to see this. Wellness company has a plan to actually have community dentistry and having a dental division. Yeah, mental health. You know, most of mental health is
no one wants to talk about that.
Telemedicine. So much in the future for the Wellness company.
Doctor, I think in the course of this hour, we know what an innovator you are. But first and foremost, you are a doctor who cares for his patients. And I am so grateful for everything you've done the last 4 years to make us a better country, a better medical society. Folks, if you want to say thank you to the doctor, if you want to make a difference in your own life, go to twc.health/justnews.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review. If you enjoy your podcast, take a moment, tell a friend to subscribe today. Send them to our website, townhallreview.com. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.